Welcome to another episode of the Gay Barchive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and joining me today is Matt Dabrowski, a former resident of New England. He has recently relocated to Edinburgh, Scotland, and established two LGBT networks there, Out Scotland and Out Britain. He's going to tell us about his history with gay bars in Connecticut, as well as a little bit of history about the Royal Vauxhall Tavern in London. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you so much, Art, for having me.
You're quite welcome. Now, I understand now you live in Edinburgh. Is that correct?
Correct. I moved here about 2 years ago.
But prior to that, most of your experience was in New England and the Connecticut area.
Correct. So I've been living in Connecticut 10 years before that with my partner. Connecticut was just a home for me. I originally grew up in New York City. So living in New York was very different. And then when I started uni, my parents moved out to Connecticut. So that's kind of what brought me over to Connecticut after uni.
Excellent. So which defunct gay club had the biggest influence on you and your ultimate career path?
Oh, that's a really good question. See, in the U.S., you don't start drinking until 21 unless you have a unless you know people. It's changed quite significantly nowadays. But definitely one of the most significant places that changed my life was the Polo Club. It was in Hartford, Connecticut. So when I first moved to Connecticut back in 2006, 2007-ish, I really didn't know anything about Connecticut and I was really missing New York, but to go out to New York was about an hour and a half. And the last thing you wanted to do was come back after a night out. So we started looking around, like asking people, hey, what's a good place to go out? And everyone was always pointing at the Polo Club, which was a big drag venue at the time. And it was quite memorable. It was a very large venue in not one of the most, it was in a shady area of Hartford, let's just put it this way. So you'd scratch your head twice thinking to go to this place, but a lot of gay venues and a lot of gay bars are nowadays. I remember the first night that I actually went to the Polo Club, and I was just mesmerized by the people. A lot, I mean, it was a community all on its own, from the drag performers to the staff, to the locals. It was a great night even for straight people to come out for their, what do they call it? Hen nights. Oh, I see. It's funny. I've been in the UK for 2 years now and I don't know what half the stuff's called in English anymore. In American. hen do's and stag nights, basically. We were really...
like a bachelorette party.
Yeah, bachelorette party. Sorry, we call them a hen do in the UK. Your brain starts to function at different levels here when you start getting the terminology differently on everything, like biscuits and lifts. That was definitely a memorable place. And it was just one of those places that was significant because, like I said, the sense of community. The first time I arrived, I was really blown away as to how friendly and welcoming people were, even if you were an outsider or it was your first time there. And then once you started showing up on a regular basis, you really just became part of I guess the universe over there, because then everyone started knowing you by your first name. It was just a great place to catch up with people, to meet new people, and it was home. Honestly, it just felt like home for the first time, which brought me back to New York and, you know, growing up there and some of the gay bars that I remember from there.
Well, the course of my research uncovering all these bars that are gone around the country. I did stumble across some information about the Polo Club, and you mentioned it was in a less than desirable neighborhood. I believe it was called the South End. Is that correct?
Yes, correct.
And that specific location had some historic significance as the Hearthstone Restaurant. So apparently it was a longstanding venue in the Hartford scene before it became the Polo Club.
Oh, yes.
And my understanding, too, is that inside it was kind of an unusual blend of old world ambiance and new age decor with their lighting systems. And, you know, it was kind of an odd blend of cultures in there.
It was. And to be fair, it had a very cool vibe to it. So there was a formula to how the club worked, especially on Saturdays and Sundays. Now it's funny. I don't think it was open on Mondays to Thursdays. I think they opened it Fridays to Sundays only.
Yeah. Everything I've seen suggested they were open Thursday through Sunday or something.
Exactly. Yeah. And it was really great because even the layout was really interesting. It felt more like a cabaret. So there was a stage, there were small tables and chairs all over the floor. And there was a massive bar in the back. And by massive, I mean they could fit about 8 to 12 bartenders from what I remember. And there were never chairs at the bar. It was only standing space. What was really cool was also they had the smoking area outside, which was facing the main street. Now, I told you it wasn't in the most desirable area. So it's funny when you're smoking outside, or if you were a smoker and you were standing outside, you just saw this really eclectic group of people, you know, from the LGBT community. And what was really interesting was everyone who passed by was always so intrigued, like, what the hell is going on in there? And that's kind of what I remembered from the outside, because it wasn't fenced off or anything. You know, you could just see everyone. So it had this shroud of mystery over it when you walked past it and you didn't know what was going on. But what was really cool is they really did have a great lighting system, terrible sound system. I remember because it's one of those sound systems that could make you go deaf, like when you put up the volume. But they had this weird formula where they had music and then the show started. Usually the show started about 7. Then there were about 4 or 5 drag performers. And then they put on the music and you could dance for about 20 minutes. And again, back to the drag and then back to the music. So it kind of altered off and it gave you your breaks. So whether you wanted to watch the drag or you were there for the dancing, it had this nice flow to it throughout the night.
Cool. Now, one of the reviews that I had run across, I think it was on Yelp, about the bar, this person said it was, quote, an outrageously fun bar, known for featuring more than 50 original cocktails, including the Dirty Sex on My Face martini. Do you remember those cocktails?
Yes, I do. Surprisingly enough, I do. And I remember, now that you mention it, I remember having that last one quite a few times.
Was it because it tasted good or because you loved saying that?
Well, it was a good drink, but what I really remember about that drink was, especially when the bartenders do you, you know, the free pouring was quite incredible. So at the end of the day, I took 3. I remember it usually just took 2 to 4 drinks, and it got you absolutely pished, as we say in Scotland, or drunk. Again, the vocabulary just changes a little bit when you move here. But yeah, I remember it always took 2 to 4 drinks and then you were gone. Didn't take much.
Now, the Polo Club was like the staple bar in Hartford, right? It was like the biggest, most popular gay bar in the Hartford area. Were they involved at all? I know you were involved in leadership of the Connecticut LGBT Chamber of Commerce. Were they involved with organizations like the Chamber of Commerce and some of the other charities, or were they just kind of a business that didn't do anything?
So they were involved. This is where it differs. So I came into the LGBT activism scene quite later, and in the political arena quite a bit later, probably towards the end of my late 20s, early 30s. My remembrance of a lot of what the Polo Club was when I first came to Connecticut and I was in my early 20s. So there was definitely a big differentiation there, and I wasn't very involved in the LGBT community at the time. So I do remember later on, we did try to get them a lot more involved, but the ambiance and the prominence of the bar wasn't as it was 5 to 10 years back before that.
I see. Well, at any event, they obviously made an impression on you. And from what I've been able to discover, they made a pretty good impression on the Hartford scene in general. They've been gone a few years though now, correct? Were they gone by the time you left Connecticut?
No, actually, they closed right around that time. I'm trying to think now because gay marriage was passed in 2015, I believe. 2015 was the same time we tried to do the first Hartford Pride. A large pride event down in the city center, and they were closed by then because I remember we tried to get them engaged, and then they were having issues with licensing and things like that. And I think at that time the owners either decide to move away and sell the place, or they were ready to just close it down. It was a year or so in that time frame.
Well, that's not surprising. As my research has indicated, in the past decades, hundreds and hundreds of gay bars have closed. In the last few years alone, there's been countless number that have closed since probably 2018, 2019, some of which were operating for 30 or 40 years in the same space. So eventually, you know, all good things come to an end.
It's true. And my feedback, so I'm very opinionated about this because I think there's a space for gay bars, especially for younger LGBT folks out there. I think gay straight places cannot replace them, even if you do a gay night once a week or something like that. It's definitely a different kind of sense of community. And it's a two-way street. Sometimes these bars close because the owners really don't care much about the bars and just let them go. But I've seen a revival as well with another prominent gay bar in Hartford, which is a few streets away, called The Shea. And while the Polo was always doing very well, The Shea was kind of the dive bar that was kind of struggling. And it was in a gay bar for a very long time. And it's funny because now The Shea has been revived by new owners, and their patrons are really, I mean, every time I see the parties, it's just a full house in there.
Yeah.
So it's all about bringing back and bringing some life back to, something that was a bit older or more antiquated. And it's very doable. I just think people give up too quickly on these projects.
Well, in the course of my research, one of the premises that I've worked on is that back in the day, and even before your time, in the 70s, in the 80s, and the 90s, the gay bars were the center of everything for gay life. There would be no groups like ACT UP or HRC or any of those had it not been for a bar scene where people could meet and organize and rally and kind of collect their thoughts and share their ideas. You know, today it's a little bit different. We have social media, we have other ways of connecting, but back then the bars were the lifeblood of the community. They were everything. They were the safe havens. It's where you could go and be gay. You know, you couldn't be gay in public. You couldn't be gay at work for the most part. So, you know, that's been a strong theme in the gay community with the bars. And I think it's still needed, as you said, even for the younger community. It's great that you can go to any restaurant you want in many places and go with, you know, your husband or wife or partner of whichever gender and not have any major issues. But it wasn't always that way.
No, they definitely the bars in the past served a totally different purpose when it comes to getting together, when it came to even associating yourself with the LGBT community. They were definitely like the community centers, you could call it, back in the day. As things changed, as technology changed, and I'm a witness to that, because I went to college when Facebook came out, so I remember the purpose of Facebook was just to connect people in your dorm rooms, and you couldn't have a Facebook unless you had a university email. So it was definitely different, but I still felt like I always wanted to go to a gay bar just because I wanted to mingle and I wanted to get better music. And there was just a vibe to them that to this day, I think many still have. I just think they could be pushed a little bit more.
Now, you mentioned that you grew up in New York City. And when I asked you which defunct gay bar in the U.S. holds special memories for you, your immediate response was the Limelight in New York City in Manhattan. Tell us about that. What did the Limelight mean to you, and what does it mean to you now?
It was honestly a legendary nightclub. So Limelight was one of those rare nightclubs. And now let me think of, I know it was in the 20s. What was the address? See, it's been so long that I've lived in New York that I don't even remember what the address was, but I remember it was in the 20s. And it was an old church. It was an old church that was converted into a nightclub, which it's funny because I grew up in a very Roman Catholic family. So walking in already felt wrong. And the first vibe you had when you walked into this church was just the bar in the back where I think one of the altars where one of the altars used to be, with this massive stained glass paneling in the back. And that was just the first room you came into. That wasn't the main hall. And I just remember it had this creepy aura, but it was so cool at the same time. And my first feelings of it, and especially being in New York, you know, everyone was very, very proud, very open. So the vibe there was just incredible. The second you walked in and the music pounding, and I just remember those lights resonating from the stained glass windows. It just made such an impression on you. You didn't know if you were at some church hall getting ready to be soaked in some holy water or if you were there to party. But it felt so wrong and so right at the same time. And I remember the music was just amazing. The second the sound system they had in there, I mean, the second you heard that music, it just made your hairs grow, and just your blood started flowing, and you just never wanted to leave. It was one of those places that just captivated you and just mesmerized you.
Yeah, it was an amazing experience, and it was at 6th Avenue at 20th.
There you go. I knew it was in the 20s because I remember the neighborhood quite well.
And the building is still there.
Yes, the building is still there.
So people that have seen, you know, depictions of it in movies or wherever else, the building still exists. Last I heard, there was a restaurant there and a couple other things. I think there was a pizza shop right there on the street side of it. And it was run by a legendary nightclub owner, Peter Gation, who he did some amazing clubs. You know, there was, of course, the New York Limelight, but they also had one in Chicago, one in Atlanta, one in London, and one in South Florida down near Fort Lauderdale. So there were several locations that he recreated that crazy Limelight concept. One of my favorite memories, I was living in Atlanta while the Limelight was there, and the Limelight in Atlanta, you know, had the crazy things like wild animals under the dance floor. Sometimes they had a thick plexiglass or acrylic dance floor, and they would put wild animals underneath. But one of the most memorable parties they had was something called the Steams. And you would walk up to the door and they would hand you a grocery bag. And you would put your clothes in the grocery bag. And then they would give you a coat check and they would staple a coat check to the bag and hand you the other half of it. And they would hand you a white towel that had Limelight Steams printed on it. And you would wrap that around your waist and you would spend the rest of the night partying in this fog-filled nightclub with pounding disco music in just a towel. So it was a pretty crazy environment. But New York had a few memorable clubs like that. The Saint was one, which was actually built in a planetarium. So instead of having the vaulted ceilings of a church, you had that big arch dome of a planetarium, which was kind of crazy for lighting effects. And then, of course, there was Studio 54, which was another iconic club that I think a lot of people are surprised to when they actually look into it, that it only existed for about 3 years. Studio 54 was a flash in the pan. By today's standards, it would be forgotten, you know, by the time you heard about it. But they made an impression, and they certainly had an impact on the bar scene around the country.
They did. So funny enough that you mentioned Studio 54, I remember going in high school to see Cabaret. And we went to see Cabaret at the original Studio 54. It was actually converted back into a theater. And so that felt really awesome, because I've only heard the stories growing up, but it was actually really exciting to get to witness it and actually get to be part of it. And then I remember, so again, this was weird, everything collided when I was in New York, especially when I was going to uni. And I remember uni, one of the other places that I had the privilege of going right when they closed. I was there on closing day. Can I tell the story? I'm not sure if I'm allowed to talk about fake IDs and stuff.
I have no problem with it.
All right, perfect. So being in New York, I've always had a little bit of facial hair, but you know, unless you're 21, it's very hard to get into a lot of places. So there's always a place you can find that somebody who can make a fake ID. And I had one from Kentucky, funny enough. And I remember going to the Roxy. The Roxy was actually closing and it was their last night. And they were doing a gay night at the Roxy. And I really wanted to go. I think this was last week and they were open. And I just wanted to see for myself what it was all about. I believe I was 18, 19 at the time. And so I had my fake Kentucky ID on me. I remember going up to the front door and the bouncer asked me, he goes, you know, this is a fake. He goes, I'll give you one of two options. I either keep this and you go in, or I give it back to you. And you don't go in. So I looked at him and I said, of course I want to go in. You can keep my ID. That was just amazing that I had the actual privilege of going inside and checking out the Roxy before they closed. That was another landmark in New York
State. Yeah, and that was another weird one that was made out of a roller rink.
You could actually still roller skate on that night, because it was so large. I mean, it was just a massive, massive space.
Now, somehow, after your experiences in New England and Manhattan, a couple of years ago, you decided to pack up and move to Scotland. What was the inspiration for that?
Well, the inspiration was the kilts and the whiskey. I was always fan of both. But, you know, I've always had this weird fascination because, especially to a lot of Americans, it's quite, you know, watching Braveheart, it's quite romanticized, you know, Scotland, freedom. you're thinking of these kilted warriors running around through the Highlands. And then you look at other movies like Skyfall and you just see some of the panoramas and you're thinking to yourself, is this photoshopped? Is this actually real? Or is this all CGI in most of the movies? And believe it or not, I just decided to come here as a tourist. My job kind of burnt me out. My last job burnt me out quite a bit. And so I decided, why not come to Scotland and take a few months in Europe? Scotland was my first destination. I spent about 3.5 weeks here. And after the third day, I just knew this was my new home. The people were extremely welcoming. The panoramas and the nature are just incredible. And sorry, I've got a little puppy here. Just the country, it's one of those places I suggest everyone to try and visit and come to, especially if you're a Harry Potter fan or if you love history. I mean, Scotland's got over 3,500 castles. So it's an amazing place, and it's just crazy and unique. It's just so different, you know, haggis and Iron Brew, and the people are wild and amazing. Just decided to call it home.
I can understand that. My first international trip, when I was a teenager, I think I was about 13, we decided to go to Scotland. And the reason being that my mother actually grew up in Paisley, which is not far from where you are. I remember, you know, at 13, 14 years old, I wasn't old enough to drive yet. So we get to Scotland. We flew into Prestwick Airport, and my mother's cousin comes to pick us up at the airport in his Rover. And I was sitting in the front seat, which was really weird for me because I was sitting on what I would consider the driver's seat. Since he was driving, and on the way from the airport to Paisley, where we were staying, we had to stop for a sheep herder, his flock crossing the highway. So we had to stop and watch these sheep crossing the highway before we could continue along our way. And that was kind of my first impression of Scotland. Was seeing, you know, cattle or farm animals crossing my path in a car. But you're right. Once you get there, it's a different way of life. You know, we think in the U.S. that things like the church that the limelight's in. Oh, my goodness, that is so old. That's ancient. And you go to Scotland and you see people living in an 800-year-old house. And you're like, you know, it's a totally different perspective. So I can understand how you can fall in love with the charm of that history. Now, we had also discussed briefly some old gay bars in the UK that are gone. And you had mentioned that you were familiar with one called the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, which used to be located in London. What can you tell us about that place?
So it's honestly only stories. So again, being from New York, it's funny because I think the other major city that everyone relates to is London. It's kind of like the sister city of New York City when it comes to Europe. And I just remember a lot of people, every time they came over from London, because there was quite a large population of visitors from London when I was living in the city. They had always mentioned really cool gay bars, and I have actually not had the pleasure of going to London until recently. So unless it was a layover or something like that, but I always wanted to experience the Royal Vauxhall Tavern and never had the opportunity to do so. From my understanding, it's actually still, so I think it was closed. And then it was sustaining quite a lot of, it's a historic building. And so I believe that they had some issues funding the restoration or funding the maintenance of the building, but they went through it, and it continues to be a gay bar right now to this day. And it's been open forever. I mean, it's one of those institutions in London. And the cool thing about London is, so the mayor, Sadiq Khan, is really pushing gay bars to stay within London. And so they are trying to negotiate the rent for 20 to 40 years with the landowners so that they don't get pushed out of the bars, because one of the major issues with major cities like New York, London, is that the gay bars actually can't afford to stay there. That's why they close.
Right. And we see that in a lot of cities where developers come in and the property is more valuable than the bar enterprise itself. So either the landlords get greedy, or the developers make ridiculously high bids that the bar owners can't refuse. And whatever the case is, they end up going away. We've seen that happen. My favorite bar in Atlanta was Backstreet, which was there serving the gay community for about 3 decades. And they ended up closing for that very reason. There's a high-rise apartment complex on that property now. And it's kind of sad in a way, but you know, that's what happens, I guess, when you're in a situation where the land becomes valuable and, you know, they have to make the sensible decision. Now, the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, from my understanding, was built in the mid-19th century. So it's not, you know, it is a historic building. It's been there for a very long time. And my understanding is that it used to be a Victorian music hall, which kind of gives you an interesting perspective on the transition from Victorian music hall to gay bar. You know, yes. I mean, it's not two images that you would normally have in mind at the same time. But it certainly has a long history in London, and I believe it is still operating as the Royal Vauxhall Tavern. I'm not sure whether they're open right this, you know, this moment with all the changes that went on with COVID. But is everything over there back open now pretty much? Or
So that's a really good question. The answer is no and yes. It depends how you're looking at it. So every country here in the UK, every nation has different rules. So Scotland, we have to close bars at 10. You're allowed to play music, but there's no singing and dancing. Okay. So, whereas I just came back from Newcastle this weekend, and in Newcastle, things were open till 5 a.m. You can sing, you can dance at your table, kind of at your table, but you can't actually dance on a dance floor. So you have to still maintain social distancing. So England has quite different rules, and we've just eased off the rules here in Scotland about 8 weeks ago. So before that there was, you couldn't even get a pint inside. You can drink inside. It's all to go, delivery orders. So things have changed. I was in London back in September, on business, and, we wanted to go to the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, but it was only reservations throughout the evening. And we couldn't get in due to the fact that they were very limited on space, and they were, I think, sold out 2 or 3 weeks beforehand. So it's now changed a little bit, and now we're trying to ease off even more. But nightclubs are actually still not open anywhere. They were going to change that next week, but I believe the announcement is that due to the new COVID variant, they are still trying to hold off on nightclubs and venues for another 4 to 6 weeks.
Well, you know what they say, whatever doesn't kill us makes us stronger. Hopefully that will be the case here, and we'll endure a few more months of restrictions, and then things will start to come back to normal. Now, you'll be happy to know, perhaps, that there is a glimmer of hope. I did an interview last week with a club promoter from New York City. I don't know if you know the name, but his name is Frankie Sharp, and he was known for producing things like West Gay at the Westway, which was a big gay party event. And he and his partners, on the weekend of June 25th, Pride weekend in New York this year, are opening a brand new 4-story gay mega club called The Q, which is located on 8th Avenue at the edge of the Times Square Hell's Kitchen neighborhoods. Not only the opening, but they have several celebrity investors in the project. including Billy Porter, who is a brilliant addition to any nightclub promotion. I mean, what could better encapsulate in one person the diversity of the gay community than somebody like Billy Porter? But anyway, the point is that despite the closures of the bars and the suffering that these bars have gone through, there's at least one bold group of investors that have decided they're going to open up something grand in New York City right at the, as things are reopening after COVID.
Brilliant.
Hopefully that will be the case around the world, and we'll start seeing other fresh new mega clubs opening up and, you know, injecting some new life into our nightlife.
Brilliant. No, I think it's much needed. And I can tell you, I can tell you, having run an LGBT Chamber of Commerce in Connecticut and now running one here in the UK, one of the big things, I think, what we really need to reignite is to get young entrepreneurs to get really hyped up about these things. So again, when I was growing up, I remember the scene and I remember how much I miss it. And yes, clubs have changed, and I think that they just need to be reinvented. I think that there was a long span of time where people just gave up on reinventing anything for the LGBT community in those aspects, where they wanted to continue to grow Pride and various massive events, festivals, but they forgot about the little guys and the little places that really made a home and a community. And I think we can bring that back. We just need to reinvigorate that need and that want within the community.
So speaking of that aspect of the bar scene, what role did the bar scene have on your evolution as a gay adult?
You know what? It's a really good question. So the more I started to get to know a more various audience. So when you go to these gay bars, you meet everyone from, if you're in your 20s, you know, people your age to people who are older, to your regular patrons that come by for in their 50s, 60s, 70s, who just enjoy the music, enjoy the atmosphere. And for them, it's a safe haven because, you know, they definitely grew up in different times where discrimination was a lot more relevant and things like that. So I feel like you got to mix and mingle with people you weren't normally mixing with. And I remember having spoken to so many people, especially at the Polo Club, when you got to know what they did and you're like, you work in government, you do this, you do that. It just kind of opened your eyes up to saying, hey, wow, I'm not just a young kid who wants to like party. There's people who want to escape reality, who want to get to know more of their community as well. And so that really made an impact on my life because I was very comfortable coming out. Again, having a background of being in a very Roman Catholic family, both my parents were immigrants from Poland. It wasn't necessarily the easiest for me to be coming out, but I realized that those places made me feel more comfortable in my own skin. And it really taught me that even though I started maturing in my own profession and in other roles that I had going forward, it just made me realize this is the person that I am. And, you know, this is my family. This is my community. That, you know, we all went through our hardships being in the LGBT world, which a lot of people don't realize how difficult it is for some. But it was your one family that you had, that those local places where you could go and visit.
I have some kind of similar experiences. I also grew up as a Roman Catholic, and my mother grew up in Paisley, Scotland. My father, who is of Greek descent, actually grew up in Port Said, Egypt. So it was kind of an interesting dynamic at home, having different perspectives from outside of the U.S. As an influence on my upbringing. My grandmother, who came to live with us after she retired, had lived in Scotland for probably 40 or 50 years before she moved to the United States. So, you know, I had a lot of that external influence as well. And it was an interesting transition trying to come, grapple with the cultural values that you have from, different family background, the societal values from the neighborhoods you might have grown up in the States, the religious values, and the bars did help kind of at least give you an option to speak to other people who were having similar experiences and figure it out with their help instead of just trying to do it all on your own.
Now, yes. Yeah.
Eventually, a couple of years ago, after visiting Scotland and falling in love with it, you decided to move there. Did you immediately decide to start an LGBT chamber when you got there? Was that a plan before you decided to move? How did that evolve?
Nope. So when I came here, believe it or not, so you mentioned that you had a family who came from Paisley, and Glasgow is a little bit more it can have very conservative areas of it. But funny enough, Scotland used to be an incredibly conservative country, and now it's one of the most progressive and leading countries in the world. to the point where I believe last year the Parliament, the Scottish Parliament, had implemented LGBT history education in its curriculum in its schools, which is the first country to do so in the world. So it's Scotland has all, I believe, even on the Scottish Parliament, there's over 20 members of Scottish Parliament that are openly gay, LGBT. And so it's quite an inclusive atmosphere, and it's very unique. So when I first got here, I was working for an insurance company and I was doing their business development. And I started doing a lot of networking. But again, I really wanted to be closer to an LGBT community because professionally, which is what I was used to back in Connecticut. And it not only evolved with friendships and with common interests, but it was also something away from the party scene. And so I was thinking to myself, okay, Scotland, as progressive as it is, has to have LGBT chambers of commerce. They didn't. I started realizing there were a few networking groups here and there that did monthly kind of get-togethers, but nothing on a nationwide scale. And Scotland's a pretty big place. It only has five major cities and a population of about 5 million. But Scotland is, and most of it takes place in Edinburgh and Glasgow, which are 45 minutes away from one another by train. It seems like a very small place, but I was shocked to find out that there was nothing like this around. There were a lot of other organizations focusing on health and wellness, teens, education, safety, things like that, but nothing revolving around the business world. I started digging even further into that, and I realized, okay, there were little bits and pockets here in Brighton, London, but again, nothing central, nothing UK-wide. So I gave our friends out at the NGLCC a call, Justin and Erasmo, and I asked if they had anything planned for the UK, or if there was anything like that that was ever started. So they did a festival, an expo about a few years ago in London, and it was very successful. But again, nothing took off in terms of forming a chamber of commerce concept here. So I gave them a call again and said, listen, I'd love to do it. You know, having done it back in Connecticut with the Connecticut Gay and Lesbian Chamber, I just thought there were so many opportunities to help businesses, to help business owners, and to kind of even grow and evolve the LGBT business community here, which people at first didn't see the idea or what the point of it was. But then we started talking about everything we did back in the States. And then all of a sudden we had so much interest generating around this concept. So that's kind of how the idea took off.
Well, and it's fortunate for you that A, you had pre-existing experience with a well-developed network in the US. So you knew how the system would work. You didn't have to reinvent the wheel, so to speak. You already had a wheel to model yours after. And on top of that, there were not competitors in the market. So when you went out, you were not fighting against, well, I've already given Joe my money for the, you know, Scott Gay group or whatever he called it. And so you didn't have the competition there either, which obviously made it a little bit easier for you to hit the ground running. Did you start out Scotland and out Britain at the same time, or?
Nope. So I first wanted to start out Scotland just because Scotland was a much more manageable place. So again, the UK's got four nations, Northern Ireland, Wales, England, and Scotland. And Scotland, I live here. I live in Edinburgh. It's home. And Scottish culture is very different from the rest of the other cultures here. It's got its own language. It's got its own currency. Believe it or not, the Queen is not on Scottish pounds. So it's a very interesting and dynamic place. It has its own parliament. It has its own laws. And the laws differ from England as well. So it's a very unique and genuinely interesting place. But I wanted to make it more manageable. I knew that it was only when I was starting the business, it was just myself. And getting this off the ground would mean a lot of work trying to find LGBT businesses throughout and across Scotland. And like I said, five major cities can still be a challenge. But it's much more doable if you think about it. There's over 350,000 businesses registered in Scotland. So I'm thinking, okay, this isn't too bad. Whereas the UK as a whole, if you take the demographics, the UK as a whole has about 67 million people and over 6.5 million registered businesses. So you're talking a major, major scale of differentiation from Scotland and the rest of the UK. And this is where we kind of wanted to just focus on Scotland. Anyway, COVID hit. And so when we wanted to launch, it was about April, and then COVID hit back in March, and it just totally knocked us off all our plans that we were supposed to be doing. And what happened was we started talking to the NGLCC. We also started talking to major corporations who were very involved and who were also trying to push a lot of their supplier diversity expectations and working with the LGBT businesses. And so we realized, no, we have to do this on a UK-wide scale. We can't just do it on a Scottish scale. So that's where we kind of hired a team with me. And we officially launched a few weeks ago. And we've just been, getting things off the ground.
And that concludes another segment of the Gay Barchives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gabearchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.